This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everybody, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back.
Well, Tracy, thank you. It's nice to see you. And I was really happy to see that you had booked a program on the shoulder. Because the statistics show that it's one of the most common reasons that people go to the doctor. And some 8 million doctor visits every year because of shoulder pain.
That makes it pretty common.
That's right. And the other interesting thing about the shoulder is that of all of the joints in the body, the shoulder is the one that has by far the most emotion. Have you ever thought about that? I mean, how far you can reach to the ceiling,
sure.
You can reach behind you, you can do everything you need to do with your hand practically because of your shoulder. Hmm. It's an amazing joint. Everything from scratching your back to throwing the perfect pitch, all because of your shoulder.
Spoken like a true orthopedic surgeon.
Thank you.
Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we're going to talk with orthopedic surgeon and shoulder specialist, Dr. John Sperling. We'll find out who gets shoulder problems and what causes those problems. Also, how shoulder problems are diagnosed and how they're treated. And we'll find out what the most common shoulder problems are and find out how we might be involved.
Well, that's interesting, and I think we have brought this up previously, but I'm not. Do your kids use the Wii?
Yes, they do.
Do they really? Mm-hmm. It's still around, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're one of the millions of Americans who have a shoulder problem, you won't want to miss it. Today's guest is an internationally recognized expert on the shoulder.
But first, genetic research has opened a whole new world when it comes to understanding and hopefully curing diseases. Conditions like Alzheimer's disease, for example. At the Alzheimer's Association International Conference, which was recently held in Copenhagen, we were told about a protein discovered less than a decade ago, which appears to play a role in the development of Alzheimer's disease symptoms and why they emerge in some patients, but yet not in others. Joining us now, Dr. Keith Josephs, the Mayo Clinic neurologist and lead author in the study. Greetings, Dr. Josephs.
Good morning.
Tell us about this protein and why it's so important.
Well, the reason the protein is, well, there are many reasons that this protein is important, but I think one of the main reasons is that we have now shown that the presence of this protein is associated with the common clinical symptoms and signs of Alzheimer's disease. So what that means, for example, is that if you have this protein, we now know that patients are going to have more memory impairment, and that the main area of the brain involved in Alzheimer's disease, known as the hippocampus, is going to be more shrunken compared to patients who do not have this protein.
So if you have Alzheimer's disease, you have this protein?
So it's a little more complicated than that.
Mm.
What appears to be happening is if we're diagnosing Alzheimer's disease pathologically, and so to make that diagnosis, it requires the presence of two other proteins, tau and beta amyloid. And some folks may have heard the terms sticky plaques or neurofibrillary tangles, and that's basically the same thing. The tau protein causes or helps to form the neurofibrillary tangle, and then the plaques come from beta amyloid. So patients with Alzheimer's disease have those two proteins.
And so that's how someone who's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, possibly, you know, patient A might it will progress this way, but patient B progress the other way. Is that correct? Okay.
Correct.
So what does this mean for patients who have Alzheimer's? Is there any way you can extrapolate or use this to help find treatments for Alzheimer's?
Exactly. And I think that is why I refer to this protein as the new kid on the block. The reason is that this third protein is clearly playing a role in the degenerative process. Hence, without this protein, I don't think that it would have been possible to treat this condition. In order to treat this condition, I think that researchers who are involved in the pharmaceutical field will have to focus on this protein as well as at least one of the other proteins.
I recently saw a story about a family who, generations of this family, they develop Alzheimer's disease really early in life, like in their 30s and 40s. Do they have a certain type of this protein?
Well, that's an interesting question. And what appears to be happening is that in that family, they probably have a genetic mutation. Mm-hmm. So there are three mutations that account for Alzheimer's disease in a familial form. And what that means is that, you know, brother may have it, a father may have it, and they tend to have the disease occurring in their 30s and 40s. Now, some researchers, like myself, it's still unclear whether that condition is the same condition that I am talking about that are afflicting elderly folks in their 60s and 70s. But this protein is not common. Is not commonly seen, actually very rarely seen in folks in that would have the genetic form, which sure. makes you wonder whether they are in fact the same condition.
It could be a completely different situation.
Possibly. It could be just a genetic mutation that gives you some features that look like what we're seeing in the older folks, but it may not be the exact same disease.
So identifying this protein, does that make it easier to treat patients beforehand, or is it more likely to mean that we could figure out a cure?
The latter.
Okay.
Because I think the focus now will be, one, trying to identify this protein while patients are alive. At the present time, we can only identify the protein after death in the brain under the microscope. So the second step is trying to identify, being able to detect this protein when folks are alive. But then, once we can do that, then I think we're going to be looking at ways to treat this protein in addition to the others that I mentioned.
And is there hope that you can do that with a simple blood test?
Well, you mean to detect the protein?
Yeah.
I honestly don't think that is going to be the way. I think probably we're going to be using PET scans.
Okay.
So at the present time, we have a PET scan that can detect amyloid in the brain. I think that was approved by the FDA about three or so years ago. And just this year, there's another PET scan with the ability to detect the second protein, tau. So my suspicion is that this protein, TDP-43, detection will also be through a PET scan. I'm not sure we're going to be able to detect this protein with a blood test anytime in the next few years.
So, Dr. Joseph, just let's talk about where we are right now. And that is that at the present time, the treatments that are available can potentially slow the progression of the disease, but there is no cure right now. But it is still important for people who have Alzheimer's to be diagnosed and to get on the drugs that are available, hoping that it will not progress as rapidly. Is that correct?
Yeah, most of that is correct. The one thing I think that we're not sure about, people, some folks tend to say that the current medications that we have available for Alzheimer's slows the disease, and that is not necessarily proven.
Mm.
So the drugs that we have may improve performance on test. In other words, if a patient, 20 patients don't get the drug and 20 do, and the 40 patients do the same test, then the ones that get the drug may do slightly better. But in terms of slowing the disease, the degenerative process, there is really no evidence that any of the currently available medications approved for Alzheimer's disease slows the disease any.
Very good.
So is it important for people to know that they have it? Is it important for people to see their physician? It sounds like it's futile to try and treat this disease.
Well, at the present time, we're working on it. I wouldn't say it's futile, but we're working on trying to treat it. But it is very important for many reasons, not only for the patient, but for the family. To get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease requires an enormous amount of changes to the family situation. There's planning that needs to occur. Let's say, for argument's sake, someone has a will and they want to change it. Well, are they going to want to wait 4 or 5 years when dementia has kicked in, or do they want to make those changes early? In addition to that, as I said, that the drugs that are available, some patients do see now some benefit, and again, let me be clear, that's clinically, meaning maybe they perform better clinically, but again, no evidence that it actually slowing anything down in the brain. So yes, there is a lot of benefit for being for seeing a physician and for getting a diagnosis.
All right. Well, hopefully your recent discovery will help improve things with time. Dr. Keith Joseph, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with orthopedic surgeon and shoulder specialist Dr. John Sperling. Plus, myth or matter of fact, tears of the rotator cuff can heal without surgery. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
There's a lot of disagreement on social media about this one, so I'm anxious to find out the answer. And plus, right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our guest at 507-282-1234. Shoulder specialist, Dr. John Sperling. Also, you can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. This week's guest, orthopedic surgeon and shoulder specialist, Dr. John Sperling. Dr. Sperling, welcome back to the program. Always nice to have you. Always nice to see you.
Thanks for having me here, Tom.
You know, the most exciting thing is about shoulder surgery is that there have been these major advances in the past decade or two. Hit the highlights for us, will you? What's new?
Well, Tom, we've had a number of major advances, first in the area of shoulder replacement surgery and the advent of the reverse arthroplasty, and second is less invasive ways to take care of people with other shoulder disorders such as rotator cuff tears or dislocations.
Now, when you say arthroplasty, what does that word mean?
It means a replacement of the joint, Tom. So actually, in the United States now, the growth of shoulder replacement is five times that of hip or knee replacement.
Is that because it needs to be done that much more often, or just because you're so much better at doing it, it's a better surgery for patients to have?
It's a great question. I think it's a combination of both. So I think we have better tools available now to take care of people who had otherwise unsolvable problems in the past. And plus, with the newer technology, going through the procedure itself has become much easier for the patients.
Now, obviously, we don't walk on our hands. So the shoulder is a non-weight-bearing joint. You wouldn't think it would wear out as often as the hip or knee.
It's interesting. Over time, people's joints do wear out, and the shoulder, it does occur quite frequently, and the shoulder replacement has now been more recognized by physicians, and in that regard, they're referring patients in now to have procedures where in the past, perhaps they were told there was nothing that they could do to help them with that problem.
So it's growing five times faster, and that's because the operation is so much better than it used to be, and the indications are a little more lax than they used to be. But compare in numbers how many shoulder replacements are done in the United States versus how many total knees are done, for example.
Great question. So still, there's probably 20 times more hip and knee replacements done than shoulder replacements. The overall growth is increasing. And I think in large part, in the past, shoulder surgery had a bad name in terms of a lot of pain after the surgery itself, long recoveries. But the length of the procedures and the length of recovery has actually come down quite a bit. So it's really helped make the procedure much easier for patients to be able to go through.
Well, one of the reasons that this operation hadn't been as successful as, let's say, total hips and total knees is because of the damage to the tendons that preceded the development of the arthritis, correct?
That's exactly right, Tom.
But now, so let's talk about the rotator cuff, because that's where the action is, right?
Yes.
And you know, everybody says, oh, you know, I had problems with my rotary cuff or my, you know, and they use the wrong term, and that's okay, because you know what they mean. But it's the rotator cuff. And what exactly is that?
So the rotator cuff is our four tendons in your shoulder that help raise your arm in the air and also provide stability and also provide strength to the shoulder itself.
And that is frequently damaged, correct? What happens?
It is, Tom. Having tearing of your rotator cuff is like losing your hair or getting gray hair as we get older. So getting partial tears or on occasion full thickness tears is extremely common, and it's something that is a natural part of the aging process. Some people are able to tolerate those tears, but many people aren't able to tolerate the tearing.
So, all right, hit him with the myth or matter.
Well, hold on. I just have to, because I'm not the medical person here, so I just want to make sure I've got this. Rotator cuff isn't a bone piece of it. It's just the tendons piece of it. So equate that to the knee. Is then that like an ACL knee injury, or how? can you,
sure,
can you rotate them, or can you,
sure,
swap them out?
Sure, sure. So there's the four major muscles themselves. There's muscles that transition into tendon, and those tendons then insert into the bone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what allows you to raise your arm in the air and provide the strength. It's probably the equivalent of having your hamstrings in your knee, or actually your quadriceps in your knee itself. So it's actually a tearing of the muscle or a tendon itself.
Okay, that is a big deal when that happens in your leg.
Tears of the rotator cuff will heal without surgery. Myth or matter of fact?
I think it's a myth. I think the reality is that we see a large number of people with tearing, and it's very, very uncommon that these tears ever heal themselves on their own. Essentially, it doesn't occur.
All right, so
Can I just hold on a second here? Because I was saying, on social media, there is so much disagreement on this, that it is a myth or it is a fact. Maybe the people who are saying that it's a fact are people who did not actually have a rotator tear. Could that be possible?
I think a lot of the folks may have had partial tears of the rotator cuff, which are incredibly common. There's some people who get a lot of inflammation and pain associated with partial tears, and with cortisone injections, physical therapy, medication can settle down that pain, and that pain can resolve in many patients. So the partial tear can cause the inflammation and the pain, and for many people that settles down.
What are the symptoms?
The symptoms, I think one of the most debilitating things for patients are the primary complaint in my practice is pain at night and difficulty sleeping. So it really becomes, for the patients themselves, very incapacitating in that regard. Pain at night, also pain with activities, reaching into the back seat of a car, pain with trying to do overhead activities. Those are the most common symptoms that I see in my practice.
And the patients that come in, have they usually had an injury that brings this on, or can it just kind of happen spontaneously over time?
A combination of both. So here, of course, in Minnesota in the winter, we see people who slip on the ice, and they said, my shoulder was normal, then one day I slipped and fell, and now I can't raise my arm. And they have what we call an acute tear of their rotator cuff, something that happens all of a sudden in a tendon that was functioning well. But we also see a large number of people who over time can just start to develop symptoms. Sometimes if they overdid it in terms of activities, such as painting the side of a house or a roof, something like that. But usually it's something that progresses over time.
So you can pretty much tell or get an idea what's wrong by taking history and talking to the patient. And on exam, can you tell that they have a rotator cuff tear, or do you need a more sophisticated imaging study?
Typically on physical exam, if people have a large tear of their rotator cuff, one can tell that they're weak in that regard and they, in terms of strength, or that they have the inability to raise their arm. But a lot of it can be very subtle. And that's where some of the advanced imaging studies such as MRI or ultrasound now really are very, very important to be able to diagnose people who have smaller tears.
And then depending, what are the issues that you consider when you are trying to decide whether or not to treat this surgically or leave it alone and use, for example, physical therapy?
I think in a younger patient who has a specific episode where they tear their rotator cuff, we think more about surgery. But for the large majority of people in my practice that I see that have had symptoms over several months, we try simple non-operative things, medication, injection, physical therapy. And clearly that's the first line of treatment. And only when people have tried those things and failed, typically then do we get an MRI to take a look at the rotator cuff. Because thankfully, the chance of success with those non-operative measures can be very high and trying to help people avoid an operation.
There are folks that are responding here that I changed the way that the position I slept in, or I started doing just changing things that they were doing, and it helped to heal their shoulder. So they might have just had some sort of inflammation or a partial tear is what probably was the case.
That's correct. Particularly in the shoulder, more pain does not equal more gain. So that's important for particularly in younger active people,
sure,
who, or even older people, mm-hmm, who like to be extremely active, that if the shoulder hurts, rest is an important component of that while trying to maintain your motion. But again, just trying to force through the pain itself is not a great idea in the shoulder.
When you talk about repairing rotator cuff tears, how successful is that operation? And is it more successful if the tear has occurred recently versus an old tear?
Yeah, so people who have a tear itself that occurs with a specific episode, we try to fix those tears sooner rather than later in that regard, and the success can be better in many ways. If people have had tears going on for a very long period of time, what actually happens is when the tendon gets pulled off the bone, the muscle itself over time can turn into fat. And that can affect the long-term outcome.
Because the muscle is weakened and the muscle's gone.
Exactly, Tom. So over time, that's exactly what happens. Once that tendon is detached from the bone and taken off the bone, many times that muscle turns to fat and can compromise the outcome, particularly in someone who has a specific acute tear.
Once you repair this, and you can do this through the scope now, right?
Correct. You can do it with the scope. You can do it open, variety of different ways.
And how successful is it? I mean, I know sometimes it's hard to get the tendon repaired, correct? So what's the success rate?
The success rate is probably about 85% is a fair number. So 85% of people have a good outcome. And again, the primary goal of surgery, by and large, is pain relief. Not to make someone stronger, not to raise the arm higher in the air, but really the primary goal of shoulder surgery is pain relief.
Does physical therapy help in the non-operative situation?
Yes. So there are a number of people who have some inflammation in their shoulder. They can have some altered mechanics, we say, or just the way they move their arm that can affect or make the pain worse. So doing physical therapy can help strengthen the other muscles around the shoulder girdle and be able to help people with inflammation.
Acupuncture, does that help some of those patients?
That's interesting. That's an area that's controversial. I know some people have tried that in regard and think it helps. The tradition methods have been physical therapy, medication, injection. Those three.
Gotcha.
All right. Our guest is Dr. John Sperling, orthopedic surgeon and shoulder specialist. Coming up after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk about total shoulder replacement and a new operation, relatively new, called a reverse total shoulder arthroplasty. And we'll talk about impingement and bursitis. That's a pretty common problem, as well as shoulder dislocation and shoulder separations. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Orthopedic surgeon Dr. John Sperling is our guest. Coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. Right after that, we'll be taking your phone calls, 507-282-1234. Your comments and questions from our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, and your tweets, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Here's another reason to cut back on using that salt shaker. A study in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism shows people with type 2 diabetes who eat a diet high in salt face twice the risk of developing cardiovascular disease as those who eat less salt. The CDC reports about 29.1 million Americans have some form of diabetes, and this puts them at risk for heart disease. They also showed cardiovascular disease death rates were about 1.7 times higher among adults with diabetes than those without diabetes. Now, the other researchers say their findings support the use of low-sodium diets to reduce the rate of heart disease among people with diabetes. They say in order to reduce the risk of getting cardiovascular disease, it's important for people with type 2 diabetes to improve their blood sugar control and watch their diet. And here's news about Alzheimer's disease. Two proteins called beta amyloid and tau have become tantamount to researching Alzheimer's disease. But a Mayo Clinic study challenges the idea that these are the only important proteins that cause symptoms of this devastating disease. Now, in a large study, Mayo Clinic researchers showed that a third protein called TDP43 plays a role. In fact, people whose brain was TDP positive were 10 times more likely to be cognitively impaired at death compared to those who didn't have that protein. Here's Dr. Keith Josephs.
We know that there are some patients that interestingly have Alzheimer's in their brain, yet they're normal clinically. They don't come in with memory problems. They're fine. Why is that? And so what we think is that for those patients, TDP43 cannot be present. In other words, even you can have the Alzheimer's pathology, the two proteins, beta amyloid and tau, and you can still be normal. But when you throw in this third protein, TDP43, there's no way you're going to be normal.
And now, depression and smoking. Research shows people with depression light up twice as often as smokers who don't have a mood disorder. And those who have the toughest time quitting may have more mental health issues than they realize. Now, this is according to researchers at Concordia University who published the study in the journal Nicotine and Tobacco Research. They say people who struggle with mental illness simply have a tougher time quitting, no matter how much they want to quit. A person without clinical depression is better equipped to handle the effects of quitting, anxiety, cravings, things like that. But a bit more exercise could help. It's shown to reduce the need to smoke, even if it's not enough to stop symptoms of depression. And they found quitting was easier, even with basic exercise, such as walking. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Information You Want from Specialists Who Know. This week's guest and expert on the shoulder, Dr. John Sperling. We are on air, online, and on iHeartRadio. By the way, you can listen live to our program on your smartphone by going to KROCAM.com and you push the menu button and listen live.
Listen live.
Even a seasoned citizen like me can figure that out.
It's time for you to join our conversation. You can contact us by phone, 507-282-1234, at our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or you can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. I want to know about Wii-itis. Since my kids are playing with their Wii game, is Wii-itis really a thing that I need to be concerned about?
It actually is. So when we first came out, I saw a patient in my clinic, and we were trying to understand why he was having so much shoulder pain. And then he told me about this new game called Wii that he decided to play for 8 hours straight.
Oh, okay.
And his shoulder was actually incredibly swollen in that regard. We got an MRI, and the entire rotator cuff was inflamed and angry for overuse from Wii.
And how old was he?
He was a teenager, 18, 19 years old.
The reason why it makes a big difference is where a lot of video games you would just use your thumbs, or maybe your wrists would get hurt. With the Wii, you know, you're bowling or you're playing tennis or you're golfing. You're going through those motions. What game was he playing for 8 hours?
He was doing tennis and bowling. And he said it exactly. It's something he wasn't used to doing.
Sure.
So it's like going out on the tennis court and trying to play for 6 hours.
Exactly. All right, let's talk about shoulder replacement surgery. You mentioned that it's becoming more and more common. The indications and what's the most common reason that you do this operation?
In the past, Tom, the most common indication was arthritis, so wearing out of the joint itself, isolated arthritis. But one of the most common indications now are people who have massive rotator cuff tears or rotator cuff tears that can't be fixed, where we're able to do shoulder replacements for those patients now.
Now, is that the reverse shoulder replacement that you do or conventional, and what's the difference?
Exactly, Tom. So it's the reverse shoulder replacement. So the reverse shoulder replacement, you actually reverse the joints. So you put the ball on the socket side, and then you put a cup on the ball side. And what that does is it uses your outer muscle on the outside part of your arm, the deltoid muscle, to compensate for having a torn rotator cuff.
Interesting.
I put a video of that surgery or not a real surgery, but a radio
diagrammatic.
Right. At radio.mayoclinic.org. And in the video, it makes it look so darn simple, but it's a major surgery. And how that must be a tough one to recover from, or is it a relatively easy surgery to recover from?
It's very interesting. It's actually somewhat easier to recover from. So currently now, a shoulder replacement typically is now a 1 hour surgery, one night in the hospital, an arm in a little soft sling for 6 weeks. All the stitches are absorbable, and for most patients, they can do the physical therapy on their own at home. They actually never have to go to a physical therapist. So the procedure has changed from 5 nights in the hospital down to one, from a 3 hour operation down to 1 hour or less.
And how big is the incision? How long?
It's usually about 15 centimeters, and it's usually right on the front of the shoulder itself. and usually cosmetically pleasing the way typically it's done with absorbable sutures. And we now let people shower again 3 days after surgery. So they're able to try to get back to their activities much faster now than they were able to do in the past.
I've got all kinds of tweeted questions for us. Renate wants to know, can calcification in the shoulder tendon be absorbed naturally, or does it always require surgical removal?
Well, there's some new technology in that area. So in the past, calcific tendonitis, we would try to treat with regular cortisone injections, medication. But now there's some newer techniques that some of my colleagues at Mayo are doing where they're at, with an ultrasound machine, are able to needle those with a needle and a syringe and trying to avoid an operation. I think the success with that has been very good. A number of our colleagues in radiology, physical medicine, and rehabilitation have been doing that to help people with calcific tendonitis.
It's a new option.
Yeah, that means that the tendons of the rotator cuff have become inflamed for whatever reason or irritated, and that's itis, the inflammation. And then for whatever reason, that area calcifies or develops some mineral within it, correct? Calcific tendonitis.
Correct. And at the time of surgery, it actually looks like white Colgate toothpaste. That's the
It's soft?
It's soft. And that's the consistency of it. And it infiltrates or gets intertwined in the rotator cuff itself. And this technique of just putting a needle in there and then trying to aspirate that or pulling some of that out and washing that with the ultrasound, it has really been a very, very nice new technique. And I send all the patients that I see with that for that procedure.
All right. Gary has a question about the slap surgery. He says, was it necessary for me to have a 3-slap on my left shoulder and a 5-slap on my right? Because after the surgery, I'm now having more problems than before. So first of all, what is a slap surgery?
Yeah, it's a funny acronym. So slap is the superior labrum, anterior to posterior, and it's the lining of the inside part of your shoulder. And we typically see it in people who do a lot of overhead activity. It was actually first described in pitchers. So when that becomes detached and people have pain, one can have surgery to go in there and to repair that.
And what is 3-slap versus 5-slap? What does that mean?
It probably referred to how many little anchors were used to sew that down.
Okay.
When the surgery is done, there's a small devices that are put in the shoulder, and suture or thread comes out with those. And arthroscopically, you're able to pass those sutures through the labrum and be able to tie that down.
And why would he have more problems now than before the surgery?
With that operation, one of the bigger risks are people getting stiff after the operation.
Okay.
So the shoulder gets tight afterwards.
So the labrum is, fibrocartilage?
Correct.
Fibrocartilage, and it's a rim around the glenoid, which is the socket of the shoulder joint. And you have one around your hip also, and that can be torn. And if it's torn, that's when you have the slap surgery, huh?
Yes, I think for a number of us, people have become more conservative about treating these labral tears. And again, trying non-operative measures, physical therapy, stretching, things such as that. Only when people have tried those things and failed, only then would you think about a slap repair.
Lorraine says, I broke my shoulder and collarbone about 8 years ago, and now I'm having a lot of trouble with my arm. I can't even comb my hair anymore. That's all that her question is. If she broke her collarbone and shoulder 8 years ago, would that mean that she had that fixed and now she's having problems? Do you see that happen often?
So that's another area. There's no lack of controversy in the shoulder. And in the past, when I was training as a resident, basically all fractures of the collarbone were treated without surgery. So if the joke was, if the two bones are in the same room, they'll heal, you leave them alone.
Right.
Leave it alone. But now what we've recognized over the past couple of years are people who break their collarbone and the ends are very far apart, or we call displaced. Many of those people now do better with surgical treatment.
Right. Well, the collarbone is the only connection between the arm and the trunk, right?
Correct.
507-282-1234, orthopedic surgeon and shoulder specialist, Dr. John Sperling. Your phone calls are welcome. More tweets.
Melissa wants to know, she was responding to the, you don't really need surgery for a rotator cuff tear. She was responding to that, and she said, I tore my AC away from my collarbone 8 years ago and would like to know if that's true because it's going numb at times, and I'm wondering if it can be helped.
Yeah, so the AC is the area between the acromion and the clavicle. So that's a shoulder separation. So we see a huge number of these here in Minnesota. It's epidemic among hockey players going into the boards. Mm-hmm. People in the summer, if you fall over your bicycle, you can separate your shoulder in that regard. The large majority of those, again, can be treated without surgery. There are some people, though, who have symptoms, have continued pain that you could think about fixing those in.
All right. Let me just add now, the acromion. Now, push on the top of your shoulder there, Tracy.
Okay.
That a little bit further out.
Okay.
Out at the point of your shoulder.
Okay.
That is your acromion.
Okay.
And that is actually part of your scapula or your shoulder blade. And then that connects to the clavicle, and that's the hard bone you can feel in the front.
In the front.
Your collarbone.
Okay.
Right. So the joint that we're talking about is the acromioclavicular joint, and that's the one if somebody says they had a shoulder separation, that's what a shoulder separation is, a disconnection or an injury to the ligaments that hold those two bones together.
And often when people say they had a shoulder separation, then they're more likely to have future shoulder separations, or they
so
can even do it themselves.
Thinking about dislocations.
Okay.
All right,
so no, I have a friend whose kid, this is what happened to him. I thought that his shoulder was separated, and now he has to be careful when he's playing baseball so that it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, no, there's the confusion.
Okay.
He didn't have probably a shoulder separation. He had a dislocation.
Okay.
So once you separate your shoulder, unless it's fixed, it's over.
It's separated.
Done. It's separated. Exactly.
Exactly.
Now, a shoulder dislocation, tell us about that, Dr. Sperling.
So that's when the ball dislocates from the socket itself, and that's correct. So the younger you are when you have your first dislocation, the higher your chances are to have it continue to dislocate in the future. Mm-hmm. So if you're a young teenager, that happens once, the rate of having that happen again is very, very high. If you're older and have that happen, the chance of having that dislocate again is much lower.
Separation and dislocation, two different things.
Exactly.
Got
all
it.
Right. And now dislocation means, you know, because the shoulder has such a large range of motion, the socket is very concave. I mean, what am I trying to say?
Yeah, there's the range of motion of the shoulder, exactly, Tom, is the largest range of motion in the body, and there's more translation or more ability for the ball to move across the socket in the shoulder compared to the hip, elbow, other areas like that.
That's right. The socket is pretty flat, so it's relatively easy for the ball, which is the upper end of the arm, to come out of the socket. That's why shoulder dislocations are so common.
Got it. 507-282-1234. John has a question about our next topic, actually, frozen shoulders. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Go right ahead with your question.
I'm scheduled for an injection in my shoulder this coming week. And the doctor at Sports Medicine that looked at me said she looked at the MRI. There's a slight tear in there, but she also said something about frozen something or other capsulitis or something like that. Is that a familiar thing or a common thing?
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, well, we'll tell you.
So there are people who can develop what they term a frozen shoulder or adhesive capsulitis, and that's where the lining of your shoulder gets thicker, your motion gets restricted, and people can get pain with that. And the way that we treat people at first is exactly what they have arranged for you, is to try an injection at first. There's some evidence that's come out and shown that if you inject people early on in their symptoms, that you can decrease the length of time that they'll eventually have symptoms from this problem.
Do we know what causes this? Is it living in Minnesota?
No, not living in Minnesota with the cold. But what we can see, and it's a very good point, Tom, that you bring up, is that some people who have endocrine abnormalities, either diabetes or a problem with their thyroid, so those are some of the questions we ask at first.
Because it's more common in those people.
Exactly. It's much more common in people who have those. But it's a challenging problem because it usually happens in people between 40 and 60 years old, people who are active, and there can be quite a bit of pain associated with it.
All right. So for him, the initial treatment is going to be an injection and therapy, right? And the chances of that being successful?
They're good. So the odds are more likely than not that that'll be able to take care of the problem for him.
Hey, does that help you, John?
It sure does. It makes me feel a lot better.
All thank right, you.
Good. And we
thanks
hope you're going. Feeling even better in a week or two.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Let's go to Lori. She's calling from St. Paul. She has a question about a rotator cuff. Good morning, Lori.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Well, so I was wondering what the correlation is between mastectomies and increased, whether it's rotator cuff or shoulder injuries.
All right. Is there a relationship, John, between
mastectomy and rotator cuff?
Had a breast removed and then shoulder problems. Did you have radiation as part
no.
of? No,
no
radiation. Just the breast removed. And what about, did you have the lymph nodes in your arm removed, underneath
no.
your arm? No.
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
So I have seen a number of women who've undergone a mastectomy, and they can get some stiffness in their shoulder in the postoperative period. And I think after the mastectomy itself, due to the pain perhaps associated with that, people don't want to move their arm or shoulder, and their shoulder can become stiff in that regard. So that is something I have seen in the past.
All right.
Okay.
And then the treatment, again, would be physical therapy, possibly an injection?
Correct.
All right.
Okay.
That help,
okay.
Lori?
Well, yeah, but it wasn't really kind of associated, just a number of surgeries. I didn't have pain really after the several surgeries I had. Didn't have pain.
Okay.
Really hurt.
But
besides the shoulder pain at about surgery number 3, yeah. So
does that help? Do you have a follow-up question?
Yep, just wondering. Nope, just wondering.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Lori.
Yeah, glad you called.
All right, and back to Twitter. Sharon has a question. Can tension or stress play a role in developing long-term shoulder problems? If that's where you carry your tension, is in your shoulders, do I need to stop doing that?
Yeah. So I think there's some people who due to stress, perhaps we call altered mechanics or shrugging their shoulders or issues like that, can develop ways of raising their arm that can be and cause discomfort. But thankfully, it's not going to cause tearing itself or any major structural problems in the shoulder.
A good massage is all that we need.
I think that's right.
Okay, good.
Hey, let's follow up on shoulder dislocation quickly. We talked about that it's relatively common. We talked about the fact that if you've had one, you're likely to have another one. But isn't it also true that if you have had multiple shoulder dislocations, it has to be fixed? I mean, it's unlikely that that problem is going to go away on its own. You've stretched the capsule. You've stretched the materials, the what holds the shoulder in place.
That's right, Tom. I think if people continue to dislocate their shoulder, as you mentioned, they stretch the capsule out, and the labrum, the lining that you mentioned before, typically gets torn off the socket. And because of that, then, it makes it more likely to dislocate in the future. So we try non-operative things. We try physical therapy. But if people continue to dislocate despite that, that's when we do think about surgery.
All right. So the big things in shoulder surgery are the fact that you can do so much through the scope. Shoulder replacement growing 5 times faster than hip or knee replacement because you're so much better at it. And you have 2 options, one for the person that doesn't have the rotator cuff tear and one who has a rotator cuff tear. And then in that instance, you do a reverse total shoulder. Anything I missed? I mean, you guys have done a great job in advancing your specialty.
Thanks, Tom. It's a wonderful time to be a part of shoulder surgery. And as you mentioned, lots of advances to be able to help our patients.
How many shoulder replacements do you think you've done?
I do about 350 a year, 375 a year. So for me, it's over the past 14 years, quite a number.
14 years times 300. Can you figure that out? That's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a bunch.
It's a bunch.
All right. So anybody with shoulder trouble, see their family physician first. And then if they have a serious problem that may require surgery, see someone like you. There's several orthopedic surgeons at Mayo specialize in shoulder surgery, right?
Yes. We have 8 of us now.
Wow, incredible. Dr. John Sperling, orthopedic surgeon, shoulder specialist at the Mayo Clinic, and now new co-chairman of the department. Congratulations.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Sperling, thanks so much for being with us. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk about being dizzy with an expert, Dr. Neil Shepherd. And Tracy, you know, I know you have a personal interest in this problem. Now, I'm not saying you're dizzy.
Right. No. Yeah, a vestibular issue that I had this spring. And when I realized that there is an actual vestibular clinic within the Mayo Clinic, I thought, I can't be the only person that's going through this. And indeed, the waiting room was often full of people, young, old, you know, people who've had brain tumor or MS or other issues that have vestibular issues, which makes them feel like they are dizzy or have an imbalance.
So
it's
vestibular, that's part of the inner ear,
it
correct?
Is.
It's one of the
it
things
is.
We'll learn about. It. And I know that you like to talk about the 3 categories of dizziness because it has helped you understand it and
right.
that should help me understand it
right.
and our whole general audience next week. It's one of the most common reasons people go to the doctor, even more common than shoulder problems.
Oh, it can't be true.
Dizziness causes diagnosis and treatment next week on Mayo Clinic Radio. We hope you'll join us.
Yes, please do. And for more information on topics discussed on this program, please visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program as well as previous episodes. And go to mayoclinic.org for over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers' input on how you can better manage your own health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our technical director, Kim David. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and Dr. John Sperling, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.